Hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us for the Northwest Passage podcast on KLCC. I'm News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm Morning Edition host Ani Katz.
And I'm News Reporter Brian Bull.
In a few minutes, we'll talk with KLCC reporter Tiffany Eckert, who's been following the closure of the Nurse Midwifery Birth Center in Springfield. The facility is set to close at the end of August. But first, Ani, what are some of the top KLCC stories from this week?
So earlier this week, one of the mornings I was hosting Morning Edition, the news department got an email from the Service Employees International Union, Local 49, that they were talking about potentially striking. And these are employees of Mackenzie Willamette Medical Center. Our reporter, Nathan Bouquet, did some poking around and found rising tensions between unionized staff and management. These are about 400 workers that are in negotiations with Mackenzie Willamette about staffing and compensation issues. The next round of negotiations will be held on August 21st, and no definitive plans to strike have been made. Nathan reached out to Mackenzie Willamette, but they declined to comment. So we're kind of, it's a wait and see story, but they are negotiating.
And usually organizations generally don't comment on labor negotiations, whereas the union is more willing to share with the media.
Yes. I think they wanted to draw attention to the fact that these negotiations were even happening in the first place, and now we're just kind of waiting to see where they go. Last week, we got a tip from someone who works for KLCC, but is not on the KLCC news crew. So see, we all have our ears to the ground, right? Brian Bull did follow up on this. Eugene-based company Glory Bee let an estimated 30 employees go. An official statement says circumstances in the market required us to reduce our staff for the near future. So that's 30 employees of that local company that is, you know, big proponent of local honey and beehive equipment.
I think their last report had said they were at 190 employees. And so when I got the statement from the company president saying they now had a workforce of 160, the math that I worked out was that they had let go 30 people, although they have not officially stated 30 people, but that seems to be a safe guess, is that they've let that number go. And the tipster also helped me connect with a person who was let go, who, speaking under a condition of anonymity, my least favorite word to say on air, basically said that the layoffs were a surprise. They were sudden. At the same time, they were just trying to work through the company to get good letters of reference. So, yeah, the company is letting people go, but it sounds like they're trying to be proactive and cooperative with the people who are going.
And did you find out anything about severance packages or anything?
The only comment that this particular laid-off employee shared is that the company is trying to be as generous as possible with severance. But part of that was also to sign a non-disclosure agreement to get that severance. So that's why we had a fairly limited conversation.
So we have two stories about kind of food-related stories about the school district here in Eugene, 4J. The first one is that the school district is going to be putting reusable silverware and composting programs into their elementary schools in just a few weeks this fall when school starts. Reporter Amy Brenneman says that in a recent study, researchers found that food waste has one of the biggest impacts on climate change here in Eugene. Therefore, that's why they're making this switch. The compost is going to go back into school gardens, bring recycling. Volunteers are going to help with education because the kids are not going to be responsible after they eat their meals for sorting the silverware and making sure that the food goes into a compost bin, et cetera, et cetera. This comes along with not renewing Sodexo's contract with the district, meaning that all food is now going to be cooked, not reheated in district. Lots of new stuff happening this fall in 4J in terms of food.
And Amy got to visit their test kitchen at the Eugene School District headquarters, where they're trying to create healthy recipes with local ingredients for the schools to prepare in their kitchens. But just a caveat that they're not going to be completely home in-school cooked meals right away. It's going to be a transitional thing. So they are going to have some pre-prepared foods that they're heating up initially.
And I think this makes sense, obviously, because they haven't been cooking in schools for a very long time. And 2 months, the summer, is a very short period of time to train everybody, get new equipment installed. And so I think that is probably a good idea to just start slowly and then eat those homemade sloppy joes as soon as they're ready. Finally, we have a story from Chris Lehman, who's up in the Salem Corvallis area. Oregon workers are going to get paid time off to care for loved ones or to welcome a new baby into the family. This is due to a bill signed into law by Governor Kate Brown. A handful of Republicans joined all the Democrats in the legislature to pass it. The new law offers employees up to 12 weeks of paid leave to help a family member with an illness or after the birth or adoption of a child. It also applies to victims of domestic violence or sexual assault, and it takes full effect in 2023.
Thank you, Ani.
You're so welcome.
So last weekend, supporters of the Second Amendment attempted to hold a rally in downtown Eugene, but counter-protesters outnumbered them by quite a bit. There were two arrests and a few scuffles, but for the most part, the day was peaceful, and there were even some conversations between people with very different views. Here's one of the God, Guns, and Liberty participants, Sam Owens.
I don't normally attend rallies like this. I just felt like I should be here because, yeah, guns are a big part of American culture.
Still, the event caused anxiety. Here's a woman who we spoke to across the street at Saturday Market. Her name is Elise Edmondson.
It's heartbreaking. And I've lived here for 15 years, and I feel less safe now than I ever have.
Now, some Eugene police are headed up to Portland for a rally this Saturday that's expected to draw conservative Trump supporters and Antifa members. And so we'll see how that goes. That's Saturday the 17th up in Portland.
There was a rally, I believe, yesterday that the Portland mayor, Ted Wheeler, spoke at, along with a lot of other city leaders. And one thing that I keep reading in articles about this Saturday's protest is that none of the Portland police, I think it's almost 1,000 police officers, are allowed to take the day off on Saturday. And the fact that I guess they're still bringing up officers from other cities is interesting.
Wow. One of the more interesting videos I saw of the event, too, was posted on KLCC's Instagram, I believe filmed by Mallory Begay, our diversity fellow. And as the God's Guns and Liberty people enter the plaza, there's scuffles, there's a few fists flying, and then everyone just kind of cools off and backs off. And as far as I know, nothing else happens aside from those two arrests. But I understand that the tension was just immense.
There were scuffles throughout the event. That was the most striking because it was right when the gun carrying people tried to get into the plaza, and so there was a huge kind of pushback against them. But there were scuffles throughout the day, and the police basically said, you know, we'll only make arrests if there's a complaint filed in with these particular interactions.
How did it feel to be there in the plaza?
It was stressful. It was stressful. I mean, you know, there were guns and there were angry people, and that's not really a great combination, at least for me personally.
I don't think you're alone in that.
So, Brian, you spent some time with folks cleaning up trash from islands in the Willamette River. Tell us about that.
That's right, Rachel. Recently, I went on a pretty unusual field trip to a small island outside Maury Jacobs Park here in Eugene. There, I saw about 20 people stacking bags of junk and litter into a tethered boat, which went back and forth all morning, loading and unloading trash. Here's Joe Waxmunsky. He's Parks Ambassador, explaining what was up.
We are performing a cleanup on an island in the Willamette River. The island is below Greenway Bridge downstream. So the City of Eugene Parks and Open Spaces, in conjunction with the Lane County Sheriff's work crew, a couple EPD officers, are cleaning off the trash on the island that's been accumulated for the last few months.
This was all from a homeless encampment of about a dozen people. When I talked to Waxmunsky, he was carrying two discarded bike frames, and there are also bags of clothes, a dead car battery, a mattress, and at least 30 hypodermic needles that they gather from the site, and a cooler suspected of being used as the toilet. One parks worker loading up the truck for the dump guessed the total weight from that morning came to about a ton. And the week before, crews did a similar operation on the Ferry Street Bridge and came out of there with about 3,000 pounds of garbage. And this is all to help keep visitors and outdoor recreationists safe, as well as keep some of the more toxic materials out of the river system.
Brian, your source said that the trash had accumulated for several months. Is that typical?
Yes, and the city of Eugene would like to change that. But the islands are technically under the jurisdiction of Oregon's Department of State Lands. But there's an intergovernmental agreement that could be signed off on later this year by Governor Kate Brown that would allow the city to enforce park rules, and that would clamp down on illegal fires and camping and allow local officials to visit the islands more often.
Did you get a chance to chat with any of the homeless people living on the island?
They were largely absent during the cleanup or declined comment, but I did meet Lorena Wrights, who was there with her tent, dog, and boyfriend during the cleanup, and she told me that they usually leave the island at least once a day to exercise, and when they do so, they take their trash with them inland to throw into available garbage cans or dumpsters.
It's not their responsibility to clean up our mess. You know, it's sad that they even have to come out here and do it, but, you know, it does happen. Unfortunately, not everybody has same values and morals, but we can only do our part.
As for other cleanups, the city says it's done with them for now, but if they get more complaints like they did for the two islands recently, they'll be added again. And each one of these cleanups mentioned came to about $2,000 to $2,500 a piece. As far as a more regional story, this is kind of more in the classic grassroots David versus corporate Goliath vein. The Siskiyou County Superior Courts in California has approved a settlement between Roseburg Forest Products and the small California city of Weed. About 2,700 people live there. And this lawsuit by Roseburg against Weed had waged on for about 3 years. And the settlement essentially confirms that this wood products company based in Springfield acquired the water rights to Bohan Springs more than 30 years ago. And can divert water from there at the rate of 4 cubic feet per second. Here's Roseburg Forest Products spokesperson Rebecca Taylor on the settlement.
The city of Weed did acknowledge that it has no ownership interest in that water, and it agreed to end all claims to those water rights.
The lease does say Roseburg will provide the city of Weed with 1.5 cubic feet per second of water for the next 10 to 15 years. And city officials will be exploring alternate sources of water as well. Taylor said they'll honor that for the stated duration. During the legal wrangling, Weed citizens and city leaders contended that the 1932 Shasta River Decree guaranteed some of the Bohan Springs water for domestic and municipal use, but the judge ruled in favor of Roseburg Forest Products, affirming that they attained the water rights when they bought the Weed Veneer plant and surrounding land base from International Paper back in 1983.
You know, I think this is an interesting story because I think as populations grow and, you know, water becomes more valuable, we might see more situations like this where the residents of a city are actually, you know, trying to make sure that they have a water supply.
Right. I would not be surprised either, Rachel. I think this could be a precedent.
The Peace Health Birth Center in Springfield is set to close at the end of this month. This after the announcement was made by the Peace Health Medical Center in May. And KLCC's Tiffany Eckert has been following this story. And Tiffany, you, in your latest reporting, you spoke with an expectant mom who had been planning on giving birth at the birth center. To start with, maybe just explain how the birth center works and what makes it different from delivering in a hospital.
The birth center is run and operated by certified nurse midwives. There are 13, or were, when it was operating in normal capacity. And the difference is that, first of all, it's a house. It looks like a house from the outside, and when you walk in, rooms are kind of created, you know, positioned and decorated such very in a real comfortable kind of chill fashion. So women report that the experience is like has a home-like feel, and it's really relaxing, comforting. There's comfy chairs and tubs and beds and couches. So there's that physical part. And then giving birth in a birth center basically means that you'll be assisted by midwives, and I've learned through a midwife that the term means with woman. A midwife is with you the entire through labor and delivery, and then of course, postpartum. It's natural. So the process is, there's very low intervention, and the births are vaginal. If anything were to arise, though, nurse midwives are able to enter a hospital with a mom, and there's a backup physician because of a contract that's been created. So the difference is very stark, according to women who've given birth in birth centers and hospitals. I've talked to women who've done both. And the woman I talked to recently, her name is Marissa Ramirez. She's 29. She's pregnant with her third child. And she said she and her husband were, quote, over the moon to have their final baby, they decided, and have that baby at the birth center. So you can imagine her dismay to learn at one of her appointments, actually, at the birth center, prenatal appointments, that the center had announced that Peace Health decided to close it at the end of this month. So we're 2 weeks away. I talked to her, this month, and right now we're in a position where some of these moms are really don't know what they're going to do because the plan that they had made has been changed. And at this point, my questioning to Peace Health, I have not been given any assurance that they will keep the birth center open even long enough for the clients that they already had to follow through with delivery at the birth center as they planned.
The medical center announced this closure. And what was their reasoning for this?
It started the first time that I received a statement from the hospital in press release form, and they cited low annual numbers of deliveries in birth center, in the facility itself. Mm-hmm. Looking deeper, I found that there were more births at the birth center than had originally been stated by Peace Health. Furthermore, there was this aspect of the hospital allowing midwives to come in and help with deliveries or deliver babies in hospital because of what I earlier mentioned, this physician's agreement, contracted agreement. So that was the first reasoning, was that they just weren't enough. It wasn't sustainable mm-hmm. to keep the birth center open with so few births, it was somewhere around 70. But the numbers of babies that were born in Riverbend by midwives weren't counted in that number. And that was over 350. I think it was 377. That argument started to change. And in the story that I've just done, the feature that we're about to air, there is mention now of a concern over safety and quality, and that the model of nurse midwifery assisted birthing in the birth center brought up these questions of safety and quality. When pressed, I couldn't get any actual, specific safety concerns, but that trends, I was told by Marcy Marshall, the spokesperson at Peace Health Riverbend or Peace Health Oregon, that trends are being followed or looked at very closely by leadership, and that certain trends like women waiting longer to have babies or just the general birth rate in general going down, as if that's something, a part of the business of running a hospital mm-hmm. that you would cut because nationally rates are going down. I don't think so. I think that there'll always be a place to give birth in the hospital. So I couldn't really understand what that argument was either in terms of national trends and women waiting longer. There's all kinds of reasons why a birth center, if a woman waits too long, you won't be able to give birth in a birth center anyway. There's a cutoff at 34 years old. So right now, one of the things I can say is that they have not seemed to budge this time, and that by way of Peace Health. Twice before, they've threatened or planned to close a birth center, the birth center in Eugene Springfield area, and didn't because of community reaction.
Well, thanks, Tiffany. And folks can find Tiffany's coverage of the birth center at our website, klcc.org. You're listening to the Northwest Passage on KLCC. We'll be right back.
Support for KLCC's Northwest Passage is provided by Columbia Bank. Columbia Bank team members have experience in the unique challenges of multiple industries, from healthcare to manufacturing. Learn more about their services for the business community at columbiabank.com. Columbia Bank, where relationships rule, member FDIC.
You're listening to the Northwest Passage. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald with reporter Brian Bull and Morning Edition host Ani Katz. And now it's time for us to talk about what is sticking with us from the news this week. I heard this Thursday morning that July was Earth's hottest month on record. Federal scientists announced that the global temperature for July was 62.13 degrees Fahrenheit, which was 1.71 degrees higher than the 20th century average. That's according to the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So again, that's kind of troubling. There's also a story in the Washington Post that looks at the hottest places in the United States. And I saw Harney and Lake County in Oregon are heating up the most in Oregon. That extracted from the article.
One of the big takeaways of climate change and these increased temperatures, some people may look at these incremental increases of 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit and say, oh, what's the big deal? You know, that's just one less sweater I have to wear, or I'll just crank up the AC. But we're seeing so many ripple effects from it. Increased risk of forest fires, increased drought, increased insect activity for people who don't like bugs, and effects to breeding patterns for fish. And sometimes salmon go out to the ocean and they find that the climate change is affecting, you know, how they reproduce or their foraging for food. It just affects so many things on the level. So
go ahead.
Well, and you know, our reservoirs, our water, our lakes, algae blooms also are connected to warming climate.
And there was a video online, I cannot remember where I saw it, but it basically was this huge kind of plug had come undone on Mount Rainier, I think, this week. And it was some sort of underground gushing of water that had obviously either been frozen or was just stopped by something frozen. And it was just rushing down the mountainside. And it was a pretty incredible video, actually. And then you can only imagine, like, okay, once this builds up and it sends all this debris down, what that does once it gets to the bottom. And, you know, I'm assuming that we just start seeing more and more of that.
I have friends and scouts who did a recent trip to Glacier National Park, and they say at some point they're going to have to change the name of that park because the glaciers aren't what they used to be.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. So as we've been talking about off and on this summer, it's the 50th anniversary of Woodstock. Way back in 1969, in the tiny town of Bethel, New York, it was transformed into this like massive teeming crowd, 400,000 extra people showing up for this concert that obviously has become totally famous today. I actually went to a summer camp very close to Bethel, and that was one of the day trips we used to take, was to go visit the site, not the town of Woodstock, different place. And it's a beautiful farm. I mean, it's just, you know, rolling hills. It actually looks very small when you think about like 400,000 muddy people being in this one spot and lots of like winding, narrow country roads. So you can imagine, they, on Morning Edition on Thursday today, they talked a lot about you know, how bad the traffic was and people just abandoning their cars on the side of the road, which of course, if there were 400,000 people coming to that area, you would have to. So they had a really nice story on Morning Edition with interviews with a lot of the musicians that played, great sound clips of the music. And then they were able to find Bobby and Nick Erkeline, the couple whose image was used for the cover art of the 1970 live album, Woodstock, music from the original soundtrack and more. And they're kind of standing and hugging each other in this picture. And they actually interviewed them on Morning Edition today, and Bobby said that her intent was just go up and check it out, see what the hubbub was all about, and then get back to go to church the next day on Sunday. They did not make it back.
That's a couple that's wrapped together in the blanket.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah. Very, very famous image. So Morning Edition interviewed them, and it's a fun story, a break from the other news that's happening right now. It was definitely a nice look back.
Plans fell through for the golden anniversary, but I don't think that necessarily takes away from the event's legacy. It's such an iconic event of the 60s. People are going to remember that indefinitely.
Yeah, and if I remember correctly, I don't think Woodstock 99 went really well. So I think at this point, like, let's just leave it to like this awesome thing that happened in 1969 and just look back every year. We don't have to make a new one.
There you go. For my takeaway, a new video has just dropped from National Public Radio that shows what happens when you let Sesame Street characters become NPR interns. Cookie Monster, The Count, Bert and Ernie, Big Bird, Elmo, a handful of others, they all help notable NPR reporters anchors with their respective journalistic duties.
Guys, remember, use your NPR voices.
Good idea.
What about Oscar the Grouch?
No, they didn't feature him. I joked to Howard Berkus that Oscar the Grouch should be handling listener emails.
Actually, I would think that Oscar the Grouch should be a really good Morning Edition host, because that's probably why he's so grouchy, right? Wake up super early. And the Count would be like an amazing producer, because he could just, he's always going to make sure you hit your posts.
That's right. Right? That's right.
So exacting.
So this video was a real breath of fresh air, as Bert and Ernie would attest to. I don't think we're going to see a similar trade-off, though. I don't think we're going to see Frontline, for example, launching an investigation into who took the cookie from the cookie jar. But hey, PBS, surprise me.
I think Cookie Monster is really like my, you know, I connect most with Cookie Monster for sure.
Well, who doesn't like a cookie? I mean, come on.
They tried, I think, about 20 years ago to have Cookie Monster back off the cookies and try and endorse more fruits and vegetables. I just don't think it stuck.
Oh, come on. No. It's not the same if he's excited about carrots. I mean, they're crunchy too, but a cookie is a cookie. That's you know.
Carrot Monster just doesn't have the same ring. Tofu Monster.
Well, thanks so much for joining us for this week's edition of the Northwest Passage podcast. I'm KLCC News Director Rachel McDonald.
I'm the host of Morning Edition, Ani Katz.
And I'm reporter Brian Bull.
Support for the Northwest Passage comes from Columbia Bank, member FDIC.